All right, Pete, it is let's see, the 29th, Thursday, the 29th of May, 2025. Pete, what number was this?
Solder smoke 4 6. I'm sorry, 260.
Two
Two
six
six
zero.
zero.
Yep, he almost
Two
moved us
six.
into the 31st century there.
Yes, 260.
All right, hello, good morning, good morning, Pete, good
Wait a
morning,
minute. Crank
Dean.
it in, Robert. Crank it in, Ralph.
Crank it in, fellas. You got to crank it
Yeah.
in. Yeah. All right. Yeah, this is it's really good to see you guys here. Dean's been away for a while. Everybody is back on the net. Here we are. And I wanted to start with a quote from the old military radio net. On Saturday mornings, you guys probably know, I get up early in the morning and I log I join the old military radio net on 3885 AM. Now, I go in there with a DX100 and a Hammerlin HQ100. I don't have any old military gear, but I consider myself old and military. So, old military. I actually used a PRC something or other to make
47.
a contact from the field one time on 40 meter CW, which was completely illegal. I think the statute of limitations has expired. But anyway, the guy whoever's the net control in the old military radio net starts out with a little sort of an inspirational, kind of quotation for the assembled old military radio guys. And the last couple of weeks, he has said, KD3HT, he said, being on the leading edge is great, but sometimes being on the trailing edge is more fun. And I thought about us, because Pete is usually the one who's on the more on the leading edge, and I think Dean is a little bit less so. I am definitely on the trailing edge, so we have the full spectrum of edge occupation here. And there's one other quote that I just wanted. I share this with some trepidation, but it came up. I also listen to this net in the morning called the Southern Cross net. It's the star formation, the Southern Cross. I could actually see it from the Dominican Republic. I took a picture of it and tried to send it to the guys who run the Southern Cross net, but neither of them have good email addresses. It's it's kind of a bad sign. But anyway, I listened, and the good thing about it is that it's early in the morning, so a lot of the Australians are coming through on 20 meter single sideband. And it's usually almost always Australians and New Zealands, mostly Australians. And the Australians have this sense of humor. And this one guy was describing his antenna, which had sort of come down in a storm or something. And he just summed up the whole thing by saying, my antenna needs a lot of Viagra. Yeah, that's right. Enough said about that. We have news from Dayton and Xenia and FDIM. Again, we didn't go. Pete didn't go. Dean didn't go. I didn't go. We had a lot of people urging us to go, but our correspondent was there, Bob Crane, W8SX, who for many years has been the solder smoke correspondent at Dayton, Xenia, and FDIM. And he did interviews with Grayson, Hans, and Farhan. I think we've got the Grayson and Hans Farhan, Grayson and Hans presentations already up. We'll get Farhan's up in the days ahead. So that was all pretty good, pretty interesting stuff. Hans is, wow, Hans presented some really mind-blowingly complicated stuff. Grayson said he was a genius because Grayson said I could never do that. And neither could I. So anyway, hats off to Hans and to Grayson, and we'll hear from Farhan. Also, I'd like to mention, this is sort of related to what Grayson was up to. There was a bit of a Michigan Mighty Might revival at FDIM. They had some sort of a Michigan Mighty Might build contest. It was run by a guy named Jeff W9TH, and Grayson was selling Thermatron Michigan Mighty Might kits. So you could build a Michigan Mighty Might now for 40 meters, which I as the commander in chief of the Color Burst Liberation Army, I have decided to accept that. It's okay. It's all right. It's good. It doesn't use the Color Burst crystal, but it's okay. But anyway, there was a Michigan Mighty Might revival there. And then finally, one thing I wanted to note here, sort of in the preamble to the podcast, Farhan did an online review of Grayson's book, Hollow State Design for the Radio Amateur. And I'll just read an excerpt from Farhan's review. He says, I am compelled to set aside the future of my family and to orphan my cats to resume the work of the 250-volt power supply that I built last year. Inshallah, Allah favors those who favor thermotrons. Grayson's book is imbued with deep experimental insights and littered with gems. You have to read it over and over to find new things each time. It goes into my reference shelf in the lab. Buy it here, and then we have the link where you can buy Grayson's book. But I got a kick out of Farhan's review. He's orphaning his cats. This is a sign of deep sincerity on the part of the radio amateur, don't you think? That's good.
Or is he just worried about having his cats in the room when he reaches into that Thermotron rig with the wrong hand?
Oh, boom! A lot of cats have bitten the dust, seeking the warm quarters of those high voltage chambers. Ooh. All right. Anyway, it's time to talk about Pete's bench, because Pete has behind him the JF3HZB dial. This is the thing that we just, oh man, it is a thing of beauty. Look at that. He's got his call sign on there. Pete, why don't you tell us about what you got going on the bench?
Well, first off, let's start with the dial. This has been out for a couple of years, this dial, and it's a brilliant piece of work from JF3HZB that he came up with this actually sketch where you have the two concentric dials. So as you're moving the megahertz and the kilohertz, you can see them. And up at the top has the digital part. And I've always been intrigued by that, but it looked a little complex to do. So I said, I had the hybrid rig, which is installed right now. I said, that'd be look kind of cool. And of course, the open hole space in the hybrid rig is for a 3.2 inch display. So it took a little work to get it going. And I guess, Dean, you've done this as well. You've got one of these sitting in your shack. And it's just kind of amazing. Now, there's some limitations to this. I haven't quite got everything worked out that I want to. For instance, you can set it up for one sideband, and it'd really be nice to have both sidebands. So you have to do something with a sketch. And it uses the ESP32 processor, which, by the way, I had never used before. I had a box full of them, but I just never got around to use it. And once you start playing with it, you find it's not much different than a Arduino Nano. It's just the idea it's ESP32. But the processor itself, it's got Wi-Fi, Bluetooth. So this opens up a tremendous amount of possibilities for what you can have. But the really nice part is the ILI 9341 3.2-inch display. Big. So, I mean, I kind of get out of the way here and you can see it. And Dee, maybe you can hold yours up because you can get a better chance to see it. What size display do you have on that?
It's I don't know, 3.2 inch, something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, nice, isn't that? For solar guys, well, that's a good vision.
I just mocked it up on the breadboard here to get it working. And also because I'd never used the SP32 either. So I had to get the sketch loaded and all that. Stuff.
We are on the leading edge here, guys. You guys are anyway.
Well, kind of cool. Yeah.
I did a few things to modify it. Like I figured out how to put my call sign on there and how to put lower sideband. But it's really kind of, and the ILI 9341 is a touch screen display, so it opens some possibilities. You can put some areas with some buttons on it, and just hey, you want to change sideband, you hit it with a stylus, and there you go. So, and the ESP32, they're not expensive at all. I mean, they're competitive with what you buy a Nano for. So, really kind of neat, and it's very exciting. It's so nice to see that you have cheap technology, but you can really dress up a radio. And the other thing too is the series of sketches. The GitHub has it for different size and different types of pixels. Now the ILI 9341 is the 240 by 320, and they can get it down to like 60 by 180, which is a really small display. So you could put that circular dial in, retrofit it in a radio that has a limited panel space. So very, very nice. And it works well. So you also find that you got to pick the right kind of encoder. If you use one too fast, I mean, you're going to whistle by those digits really quick. So I have an optical encoder in there, which really makes it kind of nice. And I have it. I had to do some diddling to get the tune rate slowed down because you just tune right back by the frequency.
You got a
But
big, got a nice big old knob on that thing too, Pete. That's good. It's very important. It's actually an
those was bad
important
fingers.
ergonomic thing.
So it's just another tool in the toolkit, and having a lot of fun with it. And I have some visions of using one of the really teeny tiny displays and re retrofitting in the radio, so that may come up. But technology's there, software's there, and just at first when I looked at it, I said, "Man, this looked kind of hard." But once you get into it, it's not that difficult. Once you get one working, then you're bit by it, and you're off and running. So it makes it a nice addition. The other thing I've been doing is kind of fixing up some radios that
Well,
I've.
I want to go back first on the dial, Pete,
Yes.
because you had the really good idea of using this dial on a Heathkit monobander.
Yes.
And I got my start in sideband phone with a Heathkit HW32A 20-meter monobander, an A model where you had switchable sideband. Ooh, and a different dial. It sort of looked like an HW101, but a monobander. You need some of these rigs. So I would encourage the Solder Smoke listeners to send Pete your decent working Heathkit monobanders. Not necessarily, they don't have to send the whole power supply because you got a power supply, right? Yeah, so just send them the monobander and Pete will, dialize it. Or at least a few of them, maybe for some different bands. We don't want to we don't want to suddenly have hundreds of monobanders
The
descending
garage
on New
full.
Berry Park. No,
Well,
but
actually.
check with us, check with Pete before you send it. But if you have a monobander around, if it's gathering
Gathering
dust,
dust
gather
in the
dust,
garage.
send it to Pete. Pete will turn it into a
Yeah,
working,
I'll pay for the
useful
shipping.
radio. All right, good deal. But
Thanks
go.
for the plug, Bill. That's good. But actually, the space behind the panel is absolutely perfect for that. The ILI 9341. Beautiful. And it would look just really neat in there with the circular dial.
It's you know it's a beautiful melding of recent tech and old tech. You've got Thermotrons in there, which will warm Grayson's heart, and you've got this dial from Japan that's super cool. So yeah, all right. So send Pete some monobanders.
There you go. Yeah, thank you, Bill. Thank you. The other thing I've been doing is taking some old radios and making some changes. I had two radios that I built well, 4 or 5 years ago. One of them was a 60-meter radio, and it was channelized. It had five channels on it. As a matter of fact, the middle channel, there was some talk of allowing you to actually not have crystal control, but VFO control on one of the channels. So I worked the software so that you go into five channels, but the middle channel had an encoder associated with it so you could tune 15 kilohertz. And they actually set the range in the software so you could tune seven up and tune seven down. So it was pretty cool, but 60 meters is like a wasteland. I just don't hear much activity on it. And I said, boy, that was a waste of time. So I converted that to 40 meter channelized radio. And just some software changes, change the band pass filter, change the low pass filter, and you're on the air. And with 2.5 watts, I can actually hit the Half Moon Bay SDR receiver site, which is about 300 miles from here, and I'm running 2 and 2.25 watts. And so I've been having a few QSOs around Southern California with this channelized radio, and I picked five frequencies in the 40 meter band where there's typically nets or people hang out, and so it's pretty easy to whistle through. And one of them is FD8 right at the bottom, so you can kind of tell how the band is open. If you hear FD8 signals, the band is open. If you don't hear FD8, then it isn't.
You know, something
But
really go. I'm sorry, Dean, go ahead.
oh, it's I know where you're going. Let me just kind of get this in first because, when you talk about a channelized radio, we're gonna start thinking of you. 10-4, good buddy. We gotta watch out for those channelized radios, Pete.
Well, I think Pete's motivation though was good because he started out on 60 meters, which, like it or not, is channelized.
Is channelized, yep.
And I have been on 60 meters also, and I agree with Pete. It's kind of the no man's land there. There's nobody there. There used to be a net that used to meet on there called the Moose and Bull Net. It was
Bullwinkle, there you go.
based on the cartoon Bullwinkle, Bullwinkle and Boris and Natasha and all that. Yeah, they would meet up there. So I would talk to
But FT8 is always busy, right?
them.
But
That's right.
nobody ever talking.
Hey, but something happened with Pete's 40-meter channelized rig that I thought was really cool. One of the guys that we've been talking to about the direct conversion receiver, one of the more advanced builders, is Andy, KB7ZUT in Arizona. He said that he was tuning around with his homebrew single sideband receiver. And I'm going to put a picture of it up on the blog. And he was tuning through and he said he almost fell out of his chair because he heard this call sign coming on. Somebody who was using a homebrew radio, the 40-meter channelized rig that Pete was using, and it was N6QW. So I said, this is just, when you think about it, it's just mind-blowing. So here is a homebrew receiver picking up a homebrew transceiver, and he actually sent an SWL report in. I said, at first I thought, holy cow, this may be the first time that ever happened. But then I said, no, wait a second. It happened once, at least once before in 2015, when Rick, our friend Rick was there, and he heard me on his Lakeside direct double sideband direct conversion receiver. And he heard me struggling on 40 meters with the waterfall police, who were being kind of harsh. Anyway, so I think this may be the first time since 2015 that this has happened. So it's a decades long gap between incidents, but I thought that was really cool. And I'll put pictures. I have a picture. Pete has sent a picture of his channelized rig, and we have a picture from the Discord channel of the KB7ZUT single sideband receiver. Andy told me that his ambition is to have it working as a transceiver, and then to be able to call back with a completely homebrew transceiver. So that was pretty cool. Pete, you mentioned the MHST and the fact that you have put it on what you refer to. I'm not going to say this, but you and we use this term quite a bit, the shelf of shame. But I looked at what you said and I said to myself, wait, Pete is doing the right thing. Because sometimes when you're at loggerheads with a rig with a troubleshooting problem, and Dean knows what I'm talking about here, it's really worthwhile. And Pete, you know this better than either of us. It's worthwhile to put it on the shelf and leave it alone for a while. And then sometime during the days, weeks, hours, months ahead, you'll be in the shower or driving down the freeway, and all of a sudden, oh yeah, that thing. I forgot about that thing. I remember reading about this, and there's the importance of taking a break when you're working on a problem like this. A lot of people who have no experience with troubleshooting will think this is nuts. This is sort of pseudoscience. This is crazy. But there is actually a lot of support in anecdotal support in that other people have tried this thing and tried putting it on the shelf and leaving it alone for a while. And I guess the famous story that I read about was Ernest Rutherford, the New Zealand physicist, who in 1917 was trying to figure something out with electrons, and he took a break. He went away for the summer, and when he came back, boom. It came to him. I have the whole thing up on the Solder Smoke blog. So, Pete, we're waiting. We're looking forward sometime to the return of the MHST.
I think what happens is when you're so focused on a project and it's not working, you get blinders on, right? You don't see other, you're staring at one part of the circuit, and if you just went one component to the right or one component to the left, you might find the problem, but you simply cannot see it at that moment. And when you come back with fresh eyes, it's like, well, yeah, it would help if I had a ground wire.
A variation of this, I was reading Frank Harris's book From Crystal Sets to Sideband, and he puts in there at one point that he was building an audio amplifier, and there were a few parts on the schematic that he said, I didn't understand why they were in there. I didn't understand what they were doing, so I didn't put them in there. Which is, I mean, it's great if it works. It didn't work at this point. He said it didn't work. So then I put them in there and it worked. because they were
That's the opposite.
affecting.
That's the opposite of Munsing.
I know.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. If I
Yeah.
don't understand it, I'm not going to put it in there.
Well, I want to add a little more weight to exactly what you were saying, Bill. There's the wonderful ARRL sideband handbook, and I built a rig in there there was a 40-meter rig, mobile rig, by W6PZV. I think his name is Showers or something like that. And I built that thing really small in a nice homebrew metal case. It was nice, and it would not work. No matter what I did, I couldn't get the thing to work, and I put it on the shelf, and every once in a while I'd pull it down. So I said, I had like 3 4 days off. I said, I want to get this thing to work. So I powered it up, and I said, I just can't figure out what's wrong. So I was just going around. I said, I'll try replacing that tube because that's where I think it is. And as I started to pull the tube out, came to life. Started to work. So I said, aha, a bad tube. So I put the tube in the tube tester. The tube was good. So I got another one and I said, well, let's put a different tube in. And I put it in there and it still didn't work. So then I jiggled the tube and it started to work. It was a molded tube socket and the pin was not touching the socket because the pin was broken inside the socket. I
Yep.
mean, you could have checked all the components you wanted to, but it would not work because the problem was is so I replaced the tube socket and it started working. But I mean, it had to sit. I said it has to be something in that circuit, and it wasn't a component. It was the tube socket itself.
It's so good to hear you tell that story, Pete, because I when you know through our work with the Direct Conversion Receiver Discord group, we're running into a lot of like new builders who don't know that story, who don't understand that sometimes they could build it exactly right and it still doesn't work because there's some fault in there that they're missing. And I think a lot of guys just sort of give up. Well, I tried, you know, boop, it goes under the bench or it goes into the dresser drawer or something, never to be seen again. But the lesson from this is don't give up, go
Yeah,
back.
don't. Yeah, go back. So eventually I'll get there. Now I want to share a story with you about a broken thumb.
Oh
So
man, I have. Yeah, I thought about that. I wonder, is this the origin of the fat finger syndrome?
yeah, it could be. Take a look at my left thumb, this one here, and you'll notice it's a little kinked. And there's a wonderful story about this. First off, I broke that playing baseball, and when the doc splinted it, instead of splinting it this way, he splinted it this way. So the thumb got fixed this way. He should have split it this way, not this way. So anyway, it was summertime, early June, and I had done exceptionally well in the school year. And my dad says, I'm going to reward you for doing really well in school. And he says, we're going to buy you something. So I said, I want a Knight Kit Space Spanner radio. It was $13.95. It was a regen and a beauty had a metal panel on it. It was really neat. And I said, this is kind of exciting. So it so happened it arrived just about the time I broke my thumb. So I said, man, I'm not going to wait around weeks until that gets fixed. So I told my dad, I said, you're going to build it and I'm going to supervise you.
Early signs of a project manager.
Yeah. So we sat at the kitchen table. And he was perspiring. I said, you got to tighten that coat solder, make that resistor right. Put that there. Make sure you got the right color. He said, man, he said, you're a slave driver. And it worked the first time. But it was such a wonderful experience. He said, I did pretty good. I said, yeah, you did okay.
Well, you know, I thought that was a sign that your dad was a really good guy because there aren't too many dads who would go that far. And you know, so that's terrific. It's a wonderful story, Pete.
Now the shocker is that $13.95 Knight Kit Space Spanner. Without the, if you spend a little more, you get the rest of the metal case. I know it was a wooden case that this metal panel fit in. You can find a space spanner on eBay today, not too good shape for $150. I mean, people want these. And then they had the lesser one called the Ocean Hopper. The Ocean Hopper was different than the space spanner. It had plug-in coils, so the space spanner had a band switch, so you could change bands. This had plug-in coils, so that goes for more money because it's so rare, especially if you have one that has all the plug-in coils. I mean, it's just weird how like an Amico AC1 goes for $300. The replicas go for 250, you
Well,
know?
that's what they're asking. Whether they're
Yeah.
going to get it or not, that's a whole different story. Because I we'll talk about this when it comes to my portion. But I have a trunk load of boat anchors out there that are not moving from the trunk. I wish they would, but they're not. So Dean knows the story. But anyway, but Pete, thank you. I mean, I think this gives us more insights into the origins of the
Fat
fat
fingers.
fingers. I mean, one of the thumbs is completely misaligned.
Yes.
How could you be expected to work the TikTok? You can't do it.
You know, even to this day, I find if I do something with my left hand, a good example is that in the grocery store, you're pushing the grocery cart and you're grabbing stuff. I'm right-handed. You're grabbing stuff with the right hand. I'll find it sometimes it'll torque that, and I can feel it. I mean, this is 60 years later from when I broke this thing, and even to this day, this thing is not as strong as this one. So, I
Yeah.
mean, just
Did that end your baseball career right there?
oh, hell with
Good
that.
thing.
Yeah, hell with that. Hey, I
All
have
right.
just two small short subjects I'd like to speak about. One of them is Cycle 25.
Oh, man.
Cycle 25, and it was interesting years ago when this thing first came up, there was a lot of hype about Cycle 25 was going to be as big as Cycle 19. Well, I was fortunate. I was licensed right at the peak of Cycle 19. So I have a milestone data point of how good the bands could be. And I got to tell you, whoever's it was just a small group of scientists saying, oh, it's going to be terrific. Well, I guess what? It's not. And instead of looking at the charts, use your ears. Tune in the radio, and it's either I live in a wasteland in Southern California or it's just not there. But it's interesting. You can look at data at cycle 19, which hit a peak, a smooth peak of 300, and cycle 20, it is a smooth peak of about 150. And that's where cycle 25 is. It's already started on the downward side, believe it or not. You can look at the data from May, and you'll see the smooth curve says we're headed back the other way, and it's going to hit about 150. So it was nowhere near what these guys predict. I don't know what they were doing to predict that, but I mean, it was really hyped up, and I just don't hear it. And I'm not using a homebrew radio. I'm using a Drake R4C or a Collins. So these are professional radios that you're listening to, and it's not. You can't say, "Well, it's your radio. Your radio's not very sensitive. It's your antenna." No, because when the band is open, I'll work the DX. So I just was I've been disappointed in the results of Cycle 25, but yet you guys seem to be working a lot of DX on the East Coast. I don't hear it in Southern California.
Well, I get up early in the morning, and I've gotten into the habit of turning on the MythBuster 20-meter transceiver, and having the hex beam aimed at the west, because that's the best heading right here for the South Pacific. And just about every morning, I'm here, and there's this one guy on Rarotonga.
There you go.
Dean and I are in the running for the Workdoll Rarotonga Award.
There's two guys.
Echo 51 Juliet Delta. There's only four hams on the island. Only two of them are on regularly. One of them is kind of involved in FT8. Jim is there every morning. I say hello to him every morning. I mean, this is Rarotonga. I mean, it even sounds rare. Australians early in the morning. God, there's so many of them. There's a lot. But I agree with you, Pete. It is disappointing. It's a long way from cycle 19. And a lot of people expected it was going to be good stuff, but it just wasn't. But you could still, if you get up early in the morning, and I guess this is an advantage of FT8. A lot of the people who normally would be clogging up the SSB bands, they've just got their computer on FT8. Bye-bye. Okay. So we could talk to Jim down there on Rarotonga and all
Yeah,
the VK6s.
although I will point out that anytime there's a contest, the bands are full and you can hear people all over the place. It is not as good as it maybe once was, but the bands are open if people get on the air. I get on and call CQ and nobody answers frequently. I think a lot of people just are not hanging out on sideband when it's not an event.
Yeah. The final comment I have is about I regularly tour eBay, and I'm appalled to see how these. Bill, I can't understand it. You can't get rid of those boat anchors, but people are selling a DX40 with a missing power transformer for $200, and they're being scooped up. And I'm just saying, what has taken place? Why has this happened? Why can't you get rid of radios when at the same time you can see this stuff being sold on eBay? And I mean, I would never buy it. I
I don't
just don't
know. I mean, I
understand it.
think it might have been Nearfest up in New England, but the reports that I got there was they were selling DX60. DX60s were piled up like cordwood. And the deal was buy one, get one free.
Wow.
I mean, that's a bad sign. And not only that, we were at lunch. Dean and I, we go to the Vienna Wireless Society lunch. And there's a guy there who manages the silent key sales for the club, and a lot of this feeds into the Hamfest, the Winterfest Hamfest. So I just kind of casually mentioned, I said, "Hey, I got a DX60, a DX40, a VF1. I got a whole bunch of stuff. It's all out in the trunk of my car." And he looked at me and he said, "No, we got enough of that stuff." And we can't sell it. We can't sell it at the Ham Fest. A lot of this stuff.
We have one of the biggest ham fests in Virginia, and we get just piles of that stuff in our locker, and we put it out, and even if it's make offer, we get nothing.
Wow.
So I don't know. It's a scary times for boat anchors.
Yeah, it is. Okay, I'm done.
Thank you, Pete. We were going to talk a little bit about the direct conversion receiver news because there's been so, and a lot of this is related to Pete. Pete, your influence is very strong, even though you're not involved in the Discord group because it was a bad time for you to get involved. But I mean, we've used a quote from you a lot because a lot of times we're talking to folks who have built the receiver and then they look at it and they say, it doesn't work. Ah, it must be Dean's fault. I think it's Dean's fault. And we use the quote that you've provided, Pete, and we say, the radios do not build themselves.
Yes.
That's a quote from N6QW. And so that's been very helpful. And we've kind of emphasized the point that if you're a home brewer, part of the responsibility or part of the game is to make the thing work. It's not enough to just sit there and say, well, I built the whole thing and it's not working. No, make it work. We're aided by the fact that we now have, I think how many? 86, 86, 80,
Yeah.
85 or 86? 86 of these things built around the world. So when some guy comes along and says, well, I can't get it to work, we just kind of very politely point out, well, there are 86 people out there who did. So maybe you should just sort of take a look at that thing and maybe take a break and then come back, but you can get it working too. And it's really heartening that we have a lot of people who are getting to the point where they have the thing working, so it's really good.
Let me make a shout out, Bill. There's a
Go ahead.
couple of things. One, we have the Discord server. We started it for the direct conversion receiver project, but we now have over 600 members on the Discord server. We got maybe 30 that are pretty active, but we have channels for Thermotrons, and we have channels for sideband, and we have channels for double sideband and for transistor circuits and for digital circuits, and it's getting pretty busy. We have a lot of activity there. So if you have not joined our Discord server, join the Discord server. Second, if you have been thinking about building this direct conversion receiver but haven't jumped in yet, I want to really encourage you to jump in and build it. Again, we have 80 plus of these made. Bill and I are hoping to be the first recipients of ARRL's DCR Century Club, DCR CC Award. And we got to get 100 of these built. So it's only 16 more. So get in there and build it. And if you happen to be number 100, I'll come up with a prize for the 100th entry in the Solder Smoke DCR Challenge Hall of Fame. So if you get to number 100, there'll be a prize. It's not going to be a valuable prize, but it'll be a prize. I guarantee it. So.
Yeah, that's
Cool.
all right. There you go.
Hey, Bill, I wanted to make one small observation, and it's kind of some email traffic you and I and Dean have had here in the last couple of days. Audio hiss. Guys build the receiver and say, "Gee, I'm hearing this hiss, what have you." And to me, it's a little bit surprising. I mean, you've got to this point, and so instead of denigrating what's there, think about what would fix that. If it's an audio problem, how do you fix that? And typically, you hear a lot of these audio amplifiers, they will have a high frequency hiss. If you're lacking high frequency response, you don't hear it. So you don't worry about it. You don't worry about it. But if it's there, you can try some things like putting a capacitor across the potentiometer, the audio volume control. And I typically start out with a 10 nanofarad. And you do that, and you'll hear a reduction. Now, we'll reduce the volume. So the next point is, well, the volume goes down. Well, of course, but you eliminated the hiss.
Yeah.
So
I think
this is an opportunity to experiment and find out how can I fix this. So don't just.
that's exactly right. And it is good that we are seeing people do that kind of experiment, that kind of let's fix it. Pete, the point you make about high frequency hearing loss is important here because, well, thanks to the US Army, I don't hear these high frequency noises. I'm sure there are a lot of people out there with similar stories, but I was at first very dismissive of the folks who complained about the high frequency hiss. And there's a reason for me being dismissive, because we have found that many younger hams, younger home brewers, are just not used to noise or hiss of any kind coming out of their speaker. They think it means that something is broken. I mean, noise doesn't come out of the iPhone, noise doesn't come out of the FM stereo or the YouTube or TikTok. There's no noise there. There's noise in my direct conversion receiver. I can hear a hiss, and that means that something is wrong and something is broken. And we've tried to disabuse people of this notion. However, I also have to recognize, and Dean and I were talking about this, was that because I have the high frequency hearing loss, I'm not hearing the noise up there around 6 kilohertz, 7 kilohertz. Younger hams who don't have high frequency hearing loss maybe are hearing it. I can see it. You have like a little audio spectrum thing on your phone. You can put it right up to the speaker, and you could see it, but I can't hear it. So there is a point. Now, in terms of modifying the rig to fix that, there's pluses and minuses. One of the benefits of this receiver is that it's so simple. Dean and I, when we designed it, really designed it to be super simple. One of the reasons that we didn't put an audio high pass filter in there, some of the designs we'll see do have an audio 3KC low
Lopez.
pass filter.
Lopez, yeah.
If we had done that, it would have added complexity. We're right at the complexity limit with this thing right now, all right? In other words, we would have had to explain it. We would have had to increase the parts count. You can imagine the heartache that this would have caused. It was better, and Rick Campbell mentions this in EMRFD, it's better to run this thing as a wide open DC receiver, because that's one of the things that gives the DC receiver its charm, is that you can hear everything, right? And it makes the audio that comes out of it sound fantastic. Once you start restricting it, and by putting audio filters in there, you're sort of doing damage to the basic concept of the direct conversion receiver. So I agree with you. For those who want to go ahead and who are really bothered by the high frequency loss, go ahead, go for it. Build the audio frequency filters. What do you think, Dean?
So the other side of it is, we did this intentionally to get people motivated to build things, and people are building things. They started with the direct conversion receiver, and they said, "Well, I want to make it sound better." Whatever they think. So they're reading the literature, they're looking at EMRFD, they're building circuits, they're trying out filters, trying out CW filters. We try and temper their expectations on what they're going to get, working with this simple circuit, because there's only so far you can go with it. And I want to encourage them now to take on another project, right? Because you get to the limits of what you're going to learn with this simple receiver. Now you've built the direct conversion receiver, you can do a double sideband transmitter to go with it, right alongside. Or you could step up and say, all right, I want to build one of Pete's 57 sideband rigs, which are all well documented on his blogs at various places. But move on to try something new. But I have been delighted that we got people building crystal filters. We've got people building, working with LT Spice. We got people who are just kind of doing the homebrew thing. And I don't want to do anything to discourage that. I want them to try stuff. But we also have this kind of issue which is pervasive on the internet, which is loud voices get listened to. And so there are people who post a lot of videos on YouTube who don't have necessarily the best knowledge or the best skills. And those voices will get referenced over and over and over again. They'll come back and they'll say, well, Bill, XYZ on YouTube says this. And I'm like, okay.
Okay, you want to listen to him?
I don't want to criticize any of our brethren YouTubers out there, but some of them don't know as much as they think they know. So.
We reference phrases from Pete Giuliano very frequently. And one of the phrases that we've used is that when you've completed the direct conversion receiver, hey, congratulations, you have done something that 95% of hams never do, never even attempt. You have built a working, useful receiver, a receiver that can be used to make contacts. Congratulations. However, it has its limits. And for example, we had this guy who was trying to put audio filters in there. And I kept thinking, all right, but there's a limit to how much success you're going to have with a direct conversion receiver, because you're always going to be listening to the other side also. And I'm not quite sure whether the person who was building those filters understood that kind of technological limit. You're not going to face that limit if you do what Dean says and you move ahead and you build a super head, a single signal super head. But there's a difference. And so we kind of strike a balance between sort of inserting a dose of reality. So the lipstick on a pig is a phrase that we used. We said, when you start putting filters on the direct conversion receiver, it's sort of like putting lipstick on a pig. It's still a pig.
Heck yeah.
Or, making a silk purse out of a sow's ear, I guess, is a more correct, analogy. But it's good that guys are trying to fix it, but it's also that they reach the point of sort of diminishing returns, and it's time to move on to a different project. And that might be, for some folks, it might be approaching. But for the vast majority of people, the response has really been heartening. Guys come back and they very sincerely send messages saying, "This has been a milestone for me. I never did anything like this. I've been a ham for 45 years. I didn't think I could do it. Thanks to Dean for his videos. Thanks for showing me the way to do this thing." And so it's been really good. We've had a number of people, kind of very illustrious people, come in and build the receiver. Alan W2AEW built it. And I mean, it was so great that Alan, when he wrote the receiver, he said, and he built it in a more compact form than we normally would do. But the great thing was, he said, as he was doing that, he was starting to worry about the possibilities of feedback. And I went back and I said to the group on Discord, "Look," I said, "here is Alan Wolke, right? One of the great experts of our time. And he too is worried about feedback. It could happen. It happened to him. It happens to you. Don't feel bad if the first time you build that audio amplifier and you power
Squeals.
it up, it squeals, right?
Yeah.
They do that. All amplifiers want to be oscillators." This gets us to another quote that we use from Pete Giuliano. Giuliano was the one who told us about Barkhausen's criteria. And we mentioned this to a number of guys when they were coping with the squealing audio amplifiers that aspired to be oscillators. We would go back to them and say, "You must break the Barkhausen criteria. You must find the feedback path. Find out how the Gozauda is getting back into the Gesinnte. Break it, and it'll stop squealing." All right. So one guy, KN6FVK, wrote to us, and he said that he had solved the problem by going down to Lowe's and buying a can of Barkhausen Begone spray, and he sprayed it on the machine. So we got some
There you go.
Markhauser Brigands, but we've got Phil, W1PJE, who's the
Yeah.
director of the Haystack Laboratory at MIT. He's coming to see us. He's coming to see us in early June. And he built one. And then when he built it, he apologized. He sent us a video and he said, "Oh, you're probably going to hear a lot of noise in the background. That's fan noise from the receiver that's monitoring winds in the upper atmosphere using meteors." And I said, "Oh, cool MIT stuff. There it is." We got Indian hams. We wanted hams from India to pick up this project because, in many ways, the roots of this project lie with Farhan and his efforts to reach out to girls' schools in the Hyderabad area. So we've been talking to a fellow, Ramakrishnan, VU2JXN, and he's a long time Solder Smoke listener and fan. He was the one who suggested that we do the Solder Smoke Daily News as a blog. He was the one who did the suggestion. He was the one who came to me way back when and said, I just want to let you know that I have a child. My daughter's been born." I said, "Wow, that's great." That daughter is now has a ham radio call sign and is working on a direct conversion receiver. So times have passed. We have Punyet Singh and Ashish. Punyet Singh is VU2TUM. He's working on it, and we have Ashish, who's got a call sign from San Francisco, but is in Bangalore now, N5ASD, and they're building it. A lot of them are getting 3D printed forms from Scott W KQ4AOP. So there's kind of a worldwide kind of support system for this whole thing. It's been really been terrific. Let's see what else I got here. Oh yeah, Ramakrishnan figured out how to get the PTO forms for the tuner made in India, and he found a company that'll do it. We've gone back. Dean and I had to go back. We suddenly realized there were a bunch of receivers built in the very early stages that we didn't realize. The German students who were working with Andreas, DL1AJG, and Canadian students who were working with Daniel, VE5DLD, there were a number of them that completed this thing. Daniel, we were amazed. We wrote to Daniel up in Regina, Saskatchewan, and he said, "Oh yeah, they finished them. They took them home and they listened to them from home." He said, "I've been in touch with the students and they've made use of them." We got one receiver that was built in Singapore. We didn't even know it was in process. A guy, KM7ABZ, living in Singapore, built the receiver there. Dean found out that John, M0XJA, has eight members of his club building the receiver. We have Nick, N4AVC, got his PDO coil form printed at the local library for free. Excellent. Now, we did an April Fool's story about this whole direct conversion receiver, and we announced that the FCC was banning the use of direct conversion receivers because they were interfering with a certain satellite communications internet company. Not many people fell for this, but still, we got inspirational responses, and people were willing to admit that they were taken at least for a time. Paul VK3HN said he was taken for a few seconds. But then he said there was another story that caught his attention around, also on April 1st that talked about summits on the air AI chatbots. So, in other words, you could work a summit on the air, but you'd really would find out later on that it was just an AI, that there wasn't actually a person up there. John West wrote, he said he got a kick out of my comment about how all this had been caused by the 85th harmonic of the DC receiver. He said he didn't realize that 85th harmonic could cause such damage. All right, so let's just wrap up this whole thing about, unless Dean wants to add something, one final comment. What to do after the DCRX? This gets to what Dean was saying. Be careful who you take advice from, because especially in the internet age, anybody with a camera can set up a YouTube channel and start pontificating on what you should or shouldn't do in homebrew radio. There are very few people like Pete Giuliano who will give you the real story about what you should or shouldn't do. So be careful. Also, in terms of your follow-on project, choose wisely. Don't bite off more than you can chew. Okay, you've done a DC receiver. That doesn't necessarily mean you're ready for an SSB transceiver. People have said, oh, I've done the DC receiver. Now I want to build an SSB
Or
transceiver.
certainly not a multi-band, five-band, all-mode, SSB transceiver, right?
I actually sat down with a friend of mine and I started writing out, well, you got to do this and you got to do that. And I realized, holy cow, this is a lot. There's a lot that a lot that goes into this. This is why Frank Harris called SSB transceiver the Nobel Prize in homebrew. It's hard. So I would say just be careful and be careful not to bite off more than you can chew. Some guys can. I mean, Andy KB7ZUT has already built the single sideband receiver. I think he wisely said he's going to build the receiver first and then later on convert that to a transceiver. So there may be a two-step process there. I would restate what Dean said. Do some mods. Don't if you don't like the way the thing sounds, well, make some audio filters. Do something else. Do something. Do some mods. Also, think about building something else. What's your next project going to be? This shouldn't be the end of your homebrew experience. It should be the beginning of it. Remember to be a homebrew Elmer. All right, you picked up a lot of experience in building this receiver. Help somebody else build this receiver or build something else. That's the advice that I would put out. What do you think, Dean?
I agree. I think that's spot on. And I again, I'm just completely very pleased that we've had such a great response and that people are building. They're doing stuff. So that's great.
All right, let's see. Okay, great. All right, now, Pete. This is the portion of the show. Pete always reminds me.
Shameless Commerce Division.
Kind of an
Shameless
unusual
Commerce Division.
shameless commerce division right now. Yes, that's right. One thing I would ask people to do is check out the Solder Smoke blog, not the podcast, but the blog on the Wayback Machine. You check it. You could just do a search on the Wayback Machine or the Internet Archive of www.soldersmoke.blogspot.com and ask yourself, would this be a useful backup if Google were to suddenly pull the plug on our blog? We live in fear of this because Google has done this with so many services in the past, and they're usually pretty blunt about doing it. So with that in mind, I had asked the Internet Archive to go ahead and back up the podcast and the blog. The podcast backup looks pretty good. Almost all of the podcast episodes are backed up. The blog, I'm not quite sure whether it's in a useful form. Would this be a useful backup if Google were to pull the plug? Is the format okay? Would the template that we use be recoverable? And here's a more general question. How best should we back up the Solder Smoke blog? It scares me sometimes. I realize there's 3,000 posts on that blog, 3,000 posts on the Solder Smoke Daily News Plus, 3,000 plus. And if you include comments, it goes up way over 10,000. So there's a lot of pictures, there's a lot of videos, there's a lot of template information. And I just think it would be good if it continued to be available. If the fact that Google could pull a plug on it puts that at risk sometimes. So I ask for advice and guidance from people about what would be the best way to back up the Solder Smoke blog. It's not as easy as it seems. Dina and I have struggled with it quite a bit. And anyway, we look to you for suggestions. In terms of the Shameless Commerce Division, be a Patreon Solder Smoke sponsor. We've got a number of Patreon sponsors there. You can find it on the right-hand column of the Solder Smoke blog, how to become a sponsor. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel. When you watch one of the videos, when you watch the video of this podcast, hit the subscribe button down below. Buy your Amazon stuff through our link. We have an Amazon link over on the side. We get Bezos bucks every time you buy something through there. So if you're going to buy that signal generator or spectrum analyzer or Lamborghini through Amazon.
McLaren,
McLaren,
McLaren.
buy a McLaren. Yeah, buy it
Yes.
right there. We get 5%. We could retire on a single McLaren
300,000,
purchase.
$300,000.
Some somebody we know got a
Yeah.
McLaren.
Yeah.
Anyway, and then finally, buy your stuff from mostly DIYRF, Todd, K7TFC, up there in the Silicon Valley or the Silicon Forest around Portland. Check out his website. It's on the right-hand side of the solder smoke. He makes lots of useful kits, lots of useful boards, lots of useful parts are available there. Go check out mostly DIYRF. It's a great place to visit. Dean, tell us about what's been happening on your bench.
Well, sure. So first of all, Pete, you're talking about your shelf of shame. I don't have a shelf of shame. I've retired it. I now have the desk of despair. So that's where my parts go, the desk of despair. Because it's usually far worse than shame by the time I there's a great quote from a literary reviewer that said that this book should not be tossed lightly aside. It should be hurled with great force. That's how I feel about some of these boards sometimes. And then, your dad sounded great when he encouraged you. Here's what my dad did. He was a ham, and he had a big basket of resistors that had been pulled from rigs. I'm talking hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of resistors. And he sat me down at like 7 years old and said, "Sort these by color."
Whoa.
It took me 50 years to get my ham license because of that. So, parents. Anyway, so I've had a lot of family here. I've had people in and out. We've had a lot of activity with the radio club. First of all, the radio club had their 2 days of building the all surface mount software design receiver that our friend Oliver built, designed, and we've shared the code with Pete and so on. And I was really pleased. We had two Saturday sessions. We had about 15 builders overall. I think four or five of them have now completed the receiver, and the rest of them are on their way to having completed receivers. And this was a first ever for us because we went from schematic to layout of a circuit board to having the circuit boards fabricated before the tariffs went in. So circuit boards came in, and then Oliver was great. He put together kits for everybody, and we did the surface mount soldering, and people had the experience of grabbing one of these little surface mount parts with their tweezers and having it fling off into space, never to be seen again. So Oliver was great. He put two extra pieces of each component on the little tape on the paper that he gave everybody, except for the big active components. He kept those in his toolbox in case those got damaged. But it worked really, really well. We had a lot of fun, and group projects are fun. If you're in a club and you want to start a makers group. I knew nothing when I started the Makers Group except what I'd learned from Pete, which was a lot. But start it and get people building stuff, and the camaraderie you get. I mean, I've been reading a book about advice on aging and how to age healthily. And one of the things they say is find your tribe, right? And so we found our tribe. We got our people. So find your people, do stuff, build stuff. Group projects are fun. So my adventures have been mostly in trying to learn about how to replace those pesky clacky diodes or relays with diodes for diode switching of RF. And I've done a deep dive into all of the literature and lore and sample circuits, and I've come to the conclusion that Pete already had decades ago is why bother? It is not worth the effort. So the simple the sim if you're not familiar with what a diode RF switch is, just think of it this way. A diode is off until you put a DC bias on the anode, and then if it's up high enough, it'll become a conductive path. Well, I always thought of that as a DC sort of circuit, and I know we use them in mixers and RF goes through them, but I hadn't really conceived of it as an RF pathway before. But the way these diode switches work is You put DC on the diode to bias it forward, and then it becomes an open path for RF, and the RF will flow either direction. It does The RF doesn't care whether it's coming in from the anode or the cathode. And that was the first kind of mental hurdle I had to get over, because I was thinking that a diode was kind of a one-way path, and it's not. It's
Only for
just
DC.
only for DC. For AC, you turn it on and it's an open path. And so once you kind of get that down, it's fairly easy to say, oh, if I want RF to flow, I just need to bias the thing on. And if RF is sitting there, it'll flow across that path. And so you can fairly easily get to some there's an ARRL old QST article on a simple bandpass filter. You switch the bandpass filter in, and all the switch does is it biases one filter over another. You know, turns on the sends the bias DC signal to one set of diodes or the other. All right, pretty straightforward. But then you get into, all right, I want to use diodes to switch from transmit to receive, and I want to use diodes to switch all my low pass filters, and I want to use diodes and I'm a CW operator, and what I really want is
High speed.
instantaneous switching so that I can have full break-in. And I'm not a CW guy, so I had to actually look up what do they mean by full break-in. So here's what I think they mean. They mean when they key up, you can hear the other station on the other end, so you can hear somebody else is transmitting on top of you. And that's tough to do with relays, and it's tough to do with the kind of rigs we build, because we typically shut off the receiver when we're transmitting, right? We don't even power up those circuits, because that's the easy way to do the relays. So in order to get all of that working, the complexity level doubles, triples, gets geometrically harder. And so I looked at Farhan's circuit for the SBIDX, and just to go from transmit to receive, you got like six diodes and four FETs. And then, because we're trying to conserve power, when you don't need as much current on receive as you do on transmit, we're changing the bias level of the diodes from one level to a high voltage level. When you're going from transmit to receive, it becomes incredibly complex very quickly. And that's when I said, to quote my friend Pete again, "Basta! I have had enough of diode switching. I
We
built a couple of circuits on a bench,
were
and I gave
quoting Pete
up."
last night. We did a makers group meeting, and we were talking about this. And I pointed out, I said, we asked this question to Pete several years ago, and he said we went the question was diodes or relays? And Pete said relays, and now we understand why.
But like everything else, it's the quest for knowledge and understanding and knowing how these things work. It's like, all right, there may come a time when a diode switch in a particular circuit will be useful for me, and now I know how to do it. And I've actually built a couple of things up on the bench, and I tested them, and I even built a I said, all right, I want to build a single pole double throw switching system with diodes. And so I built it, and I could bias one side, and the one side of the switch came on, I could bias the other. So I made it work like a relay, but I don't think I'm going to put it in any of my rigs right now, at least. So
Yeah, I mean, this
that's
is, it
kind of.
reminds me the quote from Clausewitz, that one of his principles was simplicity, that
Yeah.
that planners should shoot for simplicity, because simplicity, and this it goes back to old Catholic teaching too, it's simplicity is a virtue, so
Yeah. Yeah, and then the only other thing I've done is I finally finished up the 20-meter rig that was inspired by Bill's MythBuster that uses the Yaesu VFO that Pete sent me that I bought off of eBay with a nice Yaesu 410 front panel that I built. So I finally finished that up, and I had everything done except I didn't have a top on the case that I built. So I bought a piece of Lexan at Home Depot, cut it
Ooh,
up, put it
nice.
on top so I can look down at the beautiful components. And that rig is now done. It is complete and ready to move up onto the shelf
I
in an
have
upright
seen that. I
position.
have seen that Lexan, and I am jealous. I just want to say that it's a thing of beauty, and it's really nice, and it's a nice touch there at the end. So congratulations on that, Dean.
So that's kind of it for my bench.
All right, I don't have too much to add up from my bench here because we've been very busy with the well, actually with a Shack remod that went on, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but also with the Discord group and talking to people about how to get their rigs going. I did mention early DX early in the morning. Now, I'm limited here because I have to remember at night to leave the beam aimed west. Because if I move the beam at like 3 or 4 o'clock, 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning, it wakes my wife up upstairs, and I don't want to do that. So I have to aim. If I've left the beam out west, I could talk to Jim out there in Rarotonga, but I like to talk to the VK6s because from here, from where we are, VK6 is as close to the antipode as you can get. It's about 11 or 12,000 miles away. And it's about as far as you can go without coming around the other side. So I talked a couple times to a guy named VK6JDW. I usually assume that a VK6 is in the Perth area because that's where the vast majority of people in VK6 land are. Not always. VK6JDW is way up north in the northern part of Western Australia, on near the Timor Sea. In a place called the Kimberley. I mean, the scale of these places is enormous. Just the area called the Kimberley is as big as California. It's a huge area. But what amazed me is that this area, he says he's got access to some really, really big antennas, and he could use them when they're not used for broadcasting. So I did some Google searching, and this is where HCJB, the broadcast station that we used to listen to out of Quito, Ecuador,
Ecuador?
has moved. They are now in northern Western Australia in the place called the Kimberley, and they're broadcasting to Asia, to most of the world's population, which is just north of them, in Indonesia, China, and the Philippines. And I mean, it just blew my mind to find HCJB now in VK6 land. So I've got some stuff about this on the blog. Thomas Witherspoon at the SWL Post has repeated it on his post because it's of interest to shortwave listeners. And so that was pretty cool. It's kind of fun to hear VK6 coming through early in the morning. You mentioned the desk of despair and the shelf of shame. I have a similar thing going on here right now. So Elisa correctly told me that I got to clean up my act in the shack. Especially, I had to get rid of the rug that was at least 25 or 30 years old, get rid of it, put some better flooring down. This required me to take everything out, paint the walls. It was like a major operation, but it was worth it. But I said to myself, I'm going to be selective about what I allow to come back in the shack. And so this has created sort of the stages of separation. All right. You guys mentioned the desk of despair and the shelf of shame. This is what I would call Bill's stages of separation. It goes like this. The item starts out in the shack. And right next to the shack, I have the carport or garage. So that's the first step. It goes there. If it's been there for a while and I've kind of gotten used to the idea of not having it, it'll move to the trunk of my Honda Accord car, and it sits there. So I have a number of items that have made it all the way. I have not yet gone to the landfill. The landfill, I think, is the final stage, but I don't have the heart to do that to a DX60, a DX40, and a VF1. So they're sitting in the trunk of my car. Sometimes items come back where it sat out there in the garage for a while, and then I think, well, I could really use that thing. I kind of like that. So the HP 8640B signal generator has made it back in. The Hameg 10 megahertz scope has come back in. And so that's sort of my stages of separation. That's the process that I'm using to separate myself from gear that really I should separate myself from. So I guess that's the equivalent of the desk of despair and the shelf of shame. I have those things too, but I also have a garage and the trunk of the car. Hey, that brings us to the mailbag, guys. What else? Let me see. That's all I had on my list. I wasn't doing too much here. But in the mailbag, Solder Smoke mailbag, we got an email from South Africa, from Wouter, ZS1 Kilo Echo. And he's responding to a post that I did about the question, did Soviet spies learn how to homebrew their radios? Because there was an article that appeared that said those crafty Soviets were so crafty that they actually trained their spies to go overseas to establish themselves in another country and then to gather up all the parts that they would need to make transmitters and receivers and antennas and get on the air and establish communications with Moscow Center. And I read all this and I said, nope, that's too hard. Maybe it's based on our experience with the direct conversion receiver, but I just couldn't imagine doing this and doing it regularly. You might do it, it might succeed once, maybe 1% of the time, but not all the time. I wouldn't bet the farm on this, which the story implies that that's what they were doing. So I wrote back and I said, no. Wouter came back and he said he thinks that the Soviets could do that. Hamilton in San Francisco, KD0FNR, concurs, and he wrote about it on his blog, Copacetic Flow. My response is, I don't know. What do you think, Pete? Could they do that?
I think I vote in your corner.
Maybe it
I
happened once or
think,
twice, but I don't
yeah,
think.
and it would take time to do that. I mean, acquiring one part at a time so it doesn't look like you're buying radio parts in mass
I
would be
know.
kind of tough to do. Kind of tough to do, I think. I'm in your corner.
Yeah, what do you think, Dean? There you go.
I agree. Absolutely. Not likely.
Not likely. And I think those who've not done the DC receiver project probably will be more optimistic about this than those of us who have done it. It's
But
hard.
if you know anything about my professional background, all I can say is I know a guy.
All right,
You know a guy.
we'll leave it at that. My beacon is on. Let's see. Oh no, wait. Hamilton also wrote in, KD0FNR. He supports my idea that the fireballs that we saw in the Dominican Republic this winter were in fact Starlink satellites burning in. They were not meteors. And I thought about this, and I don't think so. Hamilton said he grew up near the White Sands Missile Base, rocket launching facility in New Mexico, and he said that they would pretty regularly observe pieces of space junk or falling debris from rockets burning in from orbit, and they looked a lot like what we were seeing in the Dominican Republic. They're burning green, which usually indicates magnesium,
Magnesium, yeah.
and so I think that's what we saw there. But thanks for sending us information about that. I've got a link to another article that does agree that we were probably looking not at meteors, but at Starlink satellites that were burning in around December, January of this year. Speaking of the Dominican Republic, I left my beacon on down there, so it's still transmitting 3 watts at 28,233.5 megahertz. And Adam N0Z India Bravo heard it. He heard the beacon and sent me a report. So if you guys can listen, check it out. I do have remote control ability. I can
Control
call up
Optima.
and just say, unplug that thing. There we go, and it turned it off. We got some really nice messages from Rick N3FJZ, and he provided some great memories of the contact of the time that he came to my rescue from the waterfall police on 40 meters. And he just sent a really nice message about the direct conversion process that we've been carrying out with hams from around the world. So thanks for very much for sending that stuff in, Rick. Ron, John KN6FVK, he's the guy who has the Barkhausen Begone spray. And he had a lot of fun building his direct conversion receiver. And he actually did something that I did with one of my rigs, and that is he put all the call signs that he's received on the board. So they're like tattoos on the board. He also said that we need a high sign. I had forgotten about a high sign. This is from the Little Rascals. They had a special sign. They would go like this. And that would mean that they were part of the group. So he suggests that we, in addition to tattoos on the board, we need a high sign, just like the Little Rascals. Thanks for sending that in, John. We'll think about that. Adam, Adrian, M7EFO, he's a DC receiver builder. He's also a member of the GQRP club and gets Sprat. And so he's taken some interest in and some inspiration from Sprat. Glad to hear from you. Steve, KW4H, he writes back that that kits are just definitely not the same as homebrew. There is a distinction, and I think we've agreed we don't want to beat a dead horse there. But he points out that old boat anchor kits do have value. This gets to the Heath kits that we're asking people to send to Pete, and I agree with him there that those old boat anchor kits do have value. Mike WU2D, who makes some great videos. Mike is one of those guys that you should listen to, because and who does have a YouTube channel and does know what he's talking about. Mike WU2D, he wrote about how his old buddy Charles Kitchen has become a silent key. Charles was the designer of many of the regen radios that that a lot of us thought about building back in the day. I didn't realize that Charles had passed away. Charles was actually a friend and a colleague of Mike WU2D, so it showed up in one of Mike's videos. Craig sent in some really Craig put out some really we don't have a call sign on Craig, but he put out some really nice feedback on Hackaday regarding the DC receiver project and Dean's videos. I don't know if you've seen it, but this was really cool because it one of our articles appeared on Hackaday, and this guy said, "Oh my God, you guys must be the ones who are running the direct conversion receiver project on Discord. Those videos were great." And he was referring to Dean's videos. So that was good. Thanks for putting that in. Peter VK3TPM. Now this gets to what Dean was talking about a prize for the 100. Peter VK3TPM, who has been a longtime fan of Solder Smoke. He has his own blog. It's really good. He proposes that we come up with a certificate for members of the Solder Smoke Direct Conversion Receiver Honor Roll. And it's an interesting idea. I will just say this gets back to a lesson that Dean got from his experience as president of the local radio club. Okay, send them to us. We'll sign them and send them back. But all right, that I think that's a good idea. That's a way
My
to do it.
statement and my when I was running for president the second time of the club, and I gave kind of the speech about, about being the leader of the club. I said, this is our club, it's not my club. And I have this problem is that when anybody comes to me with a suggestion that starts with, we should do X, I get kind of hard of hearing because I don't know who we is, because usually they mean me, right? But when they come up with me and say, Dean, I want to do this project, suddenly my hearing improves greatly.
I have the same kind of response, but Peter, thanks for the idea. And Peter actually designed the certificate, so he's well on the way to actually doing it. So we would follow Dean's guidance there. I think that's some good advice. But thank you for that suggestion, Peter VK3TPM. Michael WN2A, who's really a very experienced home brewer, he wrote back and he said he used a 3-inch reflector telescope from northern New Jersey. It was the Edmonds Scientific Space Conqueror. It sounds like the same kind of vibe as Pete's receiver back then, a Space Conqueror. Phil W1PJE and Mike WN2A, the two of them got into a scientific discussion lamenting the fact that our eyes do not pick up radio frequencies, an interesting topic. And they point out that if our eyes were able to see at radio frequencies, this would be a fantastic troubleshooting tool. You could just look at the receiver and see, oh my God, look, that bandpass filter, it's not passing. It's leaking like crazy. There's a lot of stuff going in, not enough. It would be great.
It would also mean you couldn't see anything anywhere because you're bombarded with all the frequencies.
I know, but just this gets us to the second part. This would allow us to see intermodulation distortion. Think about that.
Yeah, here you go.
You could just see
Yeah.
it. And they proposed that maybe that we needed some sort of special hats that would sort of block out.
In foil.
That was my thought. I said, maybe tinfoil hats. Enough said about that. All right, guys. So maybe get some tinfoil hats. Got a shortwave listener a report. Actually, this was really cool. John, and he makes up, I think, his own call, WPE9IRS. He heard my beacon. And he wrote and he said that more shortwave listeners are switching to the ham bands than are staying on the shortwave broadcast bands. Like, I mean, when we were kids, it was all HCJB and other stations like that. But we didn't really get that. And now more of these hams are switching to ham stations. More of these shortwave listeners are switching to ham stations and monitoring that. So that's kind of good news. And I was pleased, always pleased to get a shortwave listener report. Peter, VK3YE, he found a homebrew 160 meter double sideband transceiver at a ham fest. This is kind of cool when you see guys come back from the ham fest. He also found a book, Solid State Basics for the Radio Amateur. Now, this is not to be confused with Solid State Design for the Radio Amateur, which we talk about here a lot, but this was a book that I had never heard of. Solid State Basics for the Radio Amateur, a QST anthology. And I found one on the internet and got it. And it's actually pretty good. It's more basic than SSDRA, but really good. Finally, VK2EMU, he sends a note from the Southern Cross. All right. That's from the land of the Southern Cross. And I remember I took a picture of the Southern Cross when I saw it from the Dominican Republic back in December, January. Peter says that he is going to be building the direct conversion receiver. So that's nice. I tried to send a picture of the Southern Cross to the Southern Cross Net guys, but they don't have good email addresses, so there was no place to send them. Anyway, that's it, guys. That's it. We've been going on for an hour and 25 minutes here. So any final comments here from you guys?
I
Pete.
have one. I have
Yes.
one. And again, stuff shows up in my phone and inexplicable. I mean, how did this thing show up here? And what showed up the other day was a history of radio intelligence shortly before and during World War II. And it had to do with the FBI. And it had to do with the mobile vans we always talk about.
Oh
This is
yes,
where this is.
I lived in fear that they would show up on my front steps.
And this explained why they had the mobile vans. The other thing, there was a group that was actually armed from the FCC, the special group that if they caught somebody, they could shoot them, which I didn't know. But the important thing is something I didn't realize. When you think about World War II and radio receivers, what do you think? You think about the HROs. Thousands of them built, especially in Europe and doing radio monitoring. But that was not the receiver of choice for the FCC. It was the Hallicrafters SX-28. They even had versions that they mounted in the vans so that they could use these when the direction finding loops and everything else. So they initially, for the early part of the war, the FCC was doing all the radio intelligence, not monitoring the Japanese codes and things of that sort, but they're looking for the clandestine signals. The Russians who built the radios, they were listening for those kind of guys. But it was the and then it got taken over by the military and we got more unified and more sophisticated because they had more resources. But it was just interesting to see the SX-28. I had never thought I knew about the SX-28, but I never thought that it was used in that role. I was always thinking HRO, was the HRO receiver because we see so much of that in the listening stations in England.
Well, one thing that popped up on my screen was somebody sent a YouTube clip of a video that they had produced, I think, during the war or shortly thereafter, during the Second World War, about the FCC and their efforts to create kind of an intelligence branch within the FCC. And it was a fictionalized account of this young fella who was a ham radio operator. And then they called him and he joined and they went after and they searched for the local oscillators of the German spies and the whole bit. They carried guns too. It was like the NCIS, Pete.
I mean, but it was just, I don't know why it showed up my phone, but I was intrigued by the idea that the FCC took on this role and they had an armed unit. You usually think the FBI or something like that, but it was the FCC.
There you go. They're watching you, Pete. They know all your thoughts.
Yes, there you go. Well, they're all
Bezos.
right. They look at it. They can see the radio waves coming from Newbury
Bezos
Park.
knows everything. Hey
Yeah.
guys, that's it. Thanks very much for doing solder smoke. P Dean, you got anything else?
No, I got nothing.
All
Thanks from
right.
so
Seven
long from Great Falls.
73 from Northern Virginia.
7-3s, guys.
Take it easy.